the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. LA County's stay-at-home order will stay in effect well into the summer, possibly through July or even spill into August. Despite that, California restaurants got a framework for how they could one day allow for dine-in service. We'll hear if those guidelines offer a faster track to recovery and if the state's restaurant biz can stay afloat in the meantime. Plus, why local news matters during a global crisis. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. Good amount of news this afternoon, so let's dive right in. As expected, Governor Gavin Newsom earlier today talked about how restaurants in the state might once again be able to allow dine-in service. He also talked about outdoor museums and botanical gardens, car washes, dog groomers, and other office-based businesses where telecommuting cannot be done. But whether or not any of this can happen will be based on whether the county there businesses serve can meet certain criteria that shows a containment of the virus. Currently, only Butte and El Dorado counties up north have met the criteria. The governor says he's currently in talks with 27 counties about how they can get to the point where it is safe enough to move deeper into phase two of the state's reopening plans.
We are in the spirit of collaboration and partnership and want to address those issues, and we'll be doing sort of the extent possible, again, possible on the basis, again, of public health being the foundational guideline and principle. But there are some unique characteristics within counties where they're hitting on all cylinders. We will do everything in our power as quickly as possible to adjudicate all of these nuances and details and be as fair-minded as we possibly can.
All right, so with that, let's turn now to Jot Condi. He's the CEO of the California Restaurant Association. Jot, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, what's your initial reaction to what the governor said today about how the state will determine which restaurants can open and which ones cannot?
Well, I mean, I guess, first of all, it's progress. We're here several months into the shutdown, and I think every day that passes becomes more critical for our industry. And I think the governor had mentioned, or there was a question today at a press conference, just about the mortality rate of restaurants. And we're certainly seeing that. The bills are racking up. Rent has to be paid. There's no revenue coming in for many restaurants, and those that are doing delivery only are having a hard time surviving. So we're looking at, you know, this announcement today as progress. The guidelines that he released today are protective of the employees and the public health, and are very consistent with our recommendations, along with the health directors who we collaborated with to develop some recommendations that we had for the governor. So we're encouraged that the guidelines are clear. We strongly believe that the restaurants will be able to meet those conditions and then some. We think the consumers can have confidence that when they go into a restaurant, when they're allowed to open, that the conditions will be safe and sanitized and clean.
Yeah, and that's just it, right, Jot? Because customers have to have that confidence, right? Because I know in LA County, I don't know of a single person, Jot, at least in my circle, that really wants to go and dine in a restaurant. The most they'll do is do takeout. And even that's, for some people, a stretch. It's that confidence that I think has to be there for the customer, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the customer will determine how this industry bounces back, which is why it's critical for our industry to be diligent about these guidelines that the governor has released. And I think what's different about the restaurant industry versus any other industry, the sanitation requirements, the disinfecting requirements that exist today before the COVID-19 crisis, our industry, it's in our DNA. And I think our industry is fully prepared to make that environment safe, and hopefully that the customer will feel secure in coming back.
Talking to Jot Condi, CEO of the California Restaurant Association. So restaurants, Jot, have been largely shut down for about 2 months. What's been the economic toll, and what types of restaurants have been hit the hardest by all this?
It's been devastating, and every type of restaurant has been hit hard by this. In the last week, I talked to dozens of restaurant owners from throughout California. The independent restaurants are at the greatest risk. And just in the last week, in talking to them, I've sensed a new level of crisis. Many independent restaurateurs that got into this industry because they had a passion for it, took out personal loans, made personal guarantees on loans, on lease agreements. I have talked to dozens of restaurateurs who are now having to file for personal bankruptcy because they have personal guarantees tied to their leases and their loans. You know, I think that they're starting to wonder if they can survive once they reopen.
What's your sense, Jot, that diners even want to go back and eat in a restaurant? Most polls suggest that people are okay with staying away right now, and for who knows how long.
We're paying close attention to what we're seeing in other parts of the country. And if you look at Florida, Georgia, Texas, Alaska, states that have allowed dining rooms to reopen. And we're seeing 30 to 35%, you know, operating capacity. And, you know, I think those restaurants in those states are, what we're hearing, are having a tough time. But I think it's the diligence that they need to adhere to in terms of the protective measures for their employees and for the customers that really are going to dictate whether that, you know, 35% gets, you know, to 40 to 50, hopefully 60%.
Jot, what's your expectation about how restaurants will begin to reopen and how that eventually will be regulated? I know it's asking you to look into a crystal ball and predict the future, but what do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, the health departments who regulate restaurants now and inspect every restaurant in California multiple times per year will be the ones who are likely also going to be monitoring and tracking the compliance on the COVID-related measures. Restaurants need a couple weeks really to get things going again. First of all, you need to re-engage and rehire or bring back on your employees. You need to retrain them for the new requirements and guidelines. You know, and then there's firing up the supply chains. I mean, I think every restaurateur is looking at their menu, trying to figure out, you know, what's available, the price point, going through the dining room and the operations and figuring out how to reconfigure the dining room, perhaps putting up partitions between booths. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in the next, you know, few weeks for restaurants to be able to open up and allow the customers and the employees to feel safe.
That's Jot Condi. He's CEO of the California Restaurant Association. Jot, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now let's get local reaction from our food editor at LAS.com, Elena Shatkin. Elena, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right. So as the governor was talking, LA County Health Director Barbara Ferrer said that stay-at-home orders will be in place through July unless something really significant changes in terms of our ability to contain the virus. So my sense is that we won't see any restaurants opening up back midsummer at the earliest. Is that your sense too, Elena?
That's my sense too, We're reading the tea leaves here, but it sure doesn't look like dine-in eating is going to be open in LA County restaurants in the immediate future.
Yeah, I mean, I got a place in Burbank, Elena, that I've been going to for 25 years. I've done takeout from there, but if the option was to go back inside, I can't bring myself to do it, Elena. I can't be alone in that, right? I mean, that's pretty much, I think, how a lot of people are feeling.
That's my sense of it, too, both from the consumers I've talked to and on the restaurant side. A lot of small independent restaurants are obviously, you know, concerned about reopening so that even if dine-in eating is allowed once again in restaurants, will people want to come back? And, you know, most of the people I just talked to, and this clearly isn't scientific, but it seems like most people are pretty reluctant to do that right now.
So what would it take then? Whenever it does happen, what might it look like inside these restaurants? I've been hearing some pretty wild and crazy possible solutions.
Okay, well, I will tell you this. Whenever dine-in eating does reopen at LA County and Southern California restaurants, I think it's going to look very, very different than it did in the before times. The state just released a set of proposed guidelines, and these aren't requirements that restaurants or you have to follow, but these are a set of guidelines that they'd like to see local and county officials go by as we move deeper into phase two of the reopening. And a lot of these requirements are things that, you know, we've talked about and have been bandied about before. So whenever dining does reopen, you know, dining rooms will probably be much emptier because perhaps local officials will have required restaurants to reduce their capacity so that tables are 6 feet apart. The bar areas of most restaurants will likely remain closed. You almost certainly won't be able to watch your waiter prepare tableside guacamole or Caesar salad anymore.
Wow, yeah.
You may only be able to eat with people in your household or you know, patrons who have asked to be seated together. You may have, it may require a reservation. And even with a reservation, restaurants may request that customers order in advance to limit their time inside a restaurant. So like I said, it's not going to be the same ambience and vibe that I think it was before.
I've heard some that are thinking about clear partitions in between tables and in between even individual seats, say, at a counter space area. I mean, all that, I think, is thrown out just to try and give everyone options. But at this point, I guess we can't rule anything out, right?
Yeah, those are definitely all options that restaurants could potentially take. And, you know, looking around the world at other cities and countries that have reopened, we've seen that. I've seen, you know, pictures of restaurants, I think, in Southeast Asia with partitions, plexiglass partitions in between the tables. I saw a restaurant that I think it was in Denmark that built little individual greenhouses where a table of two people could sit.
Yeah, I saw that too, yeah.
I don't necessarily think that's going to be typical here in Los Angeles, but all of these options are on the table. And whichever, you know, options restaurants or local officials take, it's going to look very, very different.
All right. That's Elena Shatkin, LAist food editor. Elena, as always, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to medical centers. Throughout the pandemic, many hospitals shifted into primarily triaging patients infected with the coronavirus. Now, that meant that many other procedures that people might have needed, ones that have nothing to do with COVID-19, had to wait. In some cases, it was because of short staffing. In other cases, it was out of concern that the virus might be transmitted to those new patients. But now, hospitals throughout Southern California are letting those procedures resume, and with more precautions in place. KPCC's investigative reporter, Ellie Yu, has the story. Ellie, welcome back.
Hi.
Now, we're specifically talking about elective procedures. Can you give us some examples of what kinds had to be postponed?
So really, any sort of non-emergency surgery had been postponed due to the pandemic. We hear the term elective a lot, and that doesn't mean that, you know, these procedures are optional. These are surgeries that don't have to take place right away because it's not an emergency, but a lot of them are medically necessary for people. Now, these are things like heart valve replacements and removing a tumor if you have cancer. And so, of course, putting off some of these surgeries can really hurt someone's health in the end.
Now, while some hospitals had to call them off weeks ago, what led them to resuming now?
Well, the governor about 3 weeks ago announced that scheduled surgeries can resume. It's as California is gradually starting to reopen. Now, there are a few reasons why they're starting back up at hospitals. I spoke to the chief medical officer at the Keck Medical Center of USC, Dr. Stephanie Hall, and she said that the decision to resume surgeries last week was a complicated one.
Everybody is struggling. When is the right time? When is it safe? When is it ethically feasible? Because there's not only the public health demand, but there's also the issue of individual needs.
So she says that the medical center was monitoring the number of COVID cases in LA County, how many COVID cases the hospitals were treating, and said for now they've seen enough of a plateau to resume some surgeries that really couldn't be put off much longer. Other hospitals are doing the same. The UC Health System, which includes UCLA Hospital, said it made the decision to start procedures again because delaying them could do more harm to a patient. A lot of hospitals, of course, are prioritizing certain procedures, like for cancer patients and people who are experiencing pain.
Sure. Now, for patients who have been anxiously waiting for these surgeries again, what new procedures do they have to follow in order to prepare?
So some hospitals are implementing testing guidelines. For example, at the Keck Medical Center, patients are required to test for the coronavirus at least 72 hours before their scheduled surgery. So if you end up testing positive for the virus, you have to reschedule your appointment. And then there are the usual precautions. You know, patients are being screened at health entrances. Everybody is required to wear a mask and to remain, you know, 6 feet apart.
When it comes to hospitals, what new precautions are they taking as they prep operating rooms?
Yeah, so things are being disinfected and cleaned pretty constantly, but I think you'll see a lot of more of a difference outside of those operating rooms, since operating rooms have been pretty sterile environments before the pandemic. You know, outside, you know, in the waiting areas, furniture has been moved so people can remain 6 feet apart. You know, hours are being expanded so that patients can be seen sort of throughout the day. And COVID patients are being isolated, of course, on separate floors. And at Keck, nurses and doctors who treat COVID patients are actually using separate elevators and walkways to stay apart and try to keep non-COVID patients safe.
All right, now, just because some hospitals are resuming elective procedures now doesn't mean that things won't change on a moment's notice. So what will administrators be closely watching as they kind of reconsider letting non-coronavirus patients into the doors?
Yeah, that's right. You know, all this reopening is very gradual because hospitals are still concerned about what they say could be a second surge. The UC Health System in its press release last week said that, you know, the resumption of services shouldn't indicate that the pandemic is over. It's just they're trying to meet non-COVID medical needs. Hospitals are trying to continue to stay ready for an influx of patients and be flexible to respond, you know, if there is a sudden increase. They still have to be prepared to have enough beds, enough ventilators, enough personal protective equipment like masks and gowns. So they're closely watching cases in LA County of coronaviruses and coronavirus, and some are making decisions on a daily basis.
All right, that's KPCC's investigative reporter, Ellie Yu, and you can read more of her story on our website, laist.com. That's laist.com. Ellie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Right now, one of the tools we know that California is going to use to try and track and also control the spread of the coronavirus is contact tracing. That's people talking to people about where they've been and who they've come into contact with. Now, digital contact tracing through your phone is another option, but it's one that comes with a whole lot of privacy concerns. Coming up, we're going to hear about an app that incentivizes you to digitally contact trace yourself, and it almost makes a game of it in all kinds of different ways. So you're going to hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
This is my song, and no one can take it away. It's been so long, but now you're here to stay. And I wonder if you know what it means.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. As more places open across California, contact tracing is set to play a crucial role in containing the spread of the coronavirus. Now, last week, Governor Newsom's administration launched a new program to train as many as 20,000 state employees to trace the spread of the virus. They'll be doing the work the old-fashioned way, by surveying people. But digital contact tracing through our smartphones is something that's also being considered. So, how much of the work could be done this way, and how would it work? Dr. Cyrus Shahabi is a professor of computer science at the University of Southern California and has been researching digital contact tracing methods and is working on an app in his lab. Doctor, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure. Now, okay, just to start us off, generally, what are the key differences between traditional contact tracing and digital contact tracing?
So traditional contact tracing, basically you have a human in the loop that goes and asks questions from somebody who's infected, a confirmed case, and they try to backtrack to a week or more and see what other contacts this person had and at what locations. The problem with the traditional contact tracing, or the challenge, is that it's usually at the beginning of the pandemic, before the pandemic starts. So usually you have a small number of cases. So this approach would work effectively. However, the current situation we are, we need to do this at a very large scale. Also, some studies show the latency is important. Basically, how quickly we can identify contacts and isolate them makes a big difference, because this COVID-19 disease actually has this feature that people can be pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic and still transmit disease. Because of that, people are suggesting the use of digital contact tracing, so that first of all, you can scale this up. Second, you can do this in a very short, basically contact people in a short time, bringing down the latency. And also, of course, help with the recall in memory, basically, for the people that you're interviewing. Sometimes they forget the locations they've been. And if you have digital contact tracing, it helps with that as well.
So you'd be able to pinpoint information a lot easier. But let me ask you this, doctor. So are we at a point here in California where traditional contact tracing is probably not going to be as effective or worthwhile?
I wouldn't go that far. I would say that we still need to have human in the loop. At least that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. However, we need to empower them with technology so that they can do their job more efficiently and more accurately. If we rely only on human contact tracer without providing them any tools, and we have a lot of tools that they can use, that, yes, I think that would be very difficult, especially given the scale that we're dealing with.
Now, let's talk about some of those tools. Probably the most talked about digital contact tracing effort is the partnership announced by Apple and Google to enable Bluetooth technology needed to do this work. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have endorsed it. Explain, doctor, how this technology would work in our daily lives.
The Bluetooth basically based technique is very simple. The idea is that if two people are close enough that they can possibly transmit the disease to each other, they are also close enough that their phone can exchange some sort of a unique identifier or a key. And later on, if one of the two, for example, get sick, then that infected person would release the keys that he or she exchanged in the past, say, week or two. And then everybody else will check and see if they see that those keys on their phone. That means that at some point in the past week or two, they were in contact with the infected person. So that's basically the technique. There are many challenges, of course, with this approach.
What are some of those challenges?
There are some practical limitations. In particular, for COVID-19, we know that we have this, what is called sometimes fomity transmission or environmental transmission, where basically somebody touches an object and then the object is contaminated and the object can transmit the disease or the virus. And this cannot be detected by this approach because, I mean, the person is already gone. So the Bluetooth and the phone is gone, basically. It also cannot detect these, what we call indirect person-to-person transmission, where person A transmit to person B and person B transmit to person C. We can only go one hop. If A is infected, we can only figure out that B is infected with this approach. And it's actually important to also inform C, because, again, because of the asymptomatic feature that this specific virus has. This is a very kind of an end-to-end and a closed solution that in practice, basically, you take human contact tracers out of the loop. And this is done by design because they want it to be extremely private in reaction to the privacy concern. But by removing the human contact tracer, basically, the system is the end-to-end solution where you alert people and notify people that we're in contact by the app itself without any human in the loop. And this may result in a lot of false alarms.
When it comes to the privacy, we you know, that's one of the issues that a lot of people have with this. With what Apple and Google are doing, is it anonymous where it doesn't require a phone number or an email address to use? Is this something that could maybe assuage some of people's concerns when it comes to privacy?
Yes, I think this is actually from a privacy perspective, the approach is, I think, the best, at least from a technology side, what they can do. But the problem is that we basically went too much to the side of privacy that potentially this end-to-end solution may not be useful anymore.
To make this effective, Doctor, how do you get people to accept the fact that maybe privacy won't be something they'll be able to enjoy when the coronavirus is spreading? And to use contact tracing in this way, digitally, it would have to maybe be something that people don't have as much of as they maybe did in the past in terms of privacy.
I don't say that they need to give up their privacy. I think we should take a very principled approach to the privacy engineering and exactly who we don't trust and what data we want to kind of keep private. And if we answer those questions, I think you can have it both ways. You can actually have effective digital contact tracing, but at the same time have certain privacy measures in place as well. So, for example, as I mentioned, one of the important data that is missed by this approach is the location data. And location data is actually very important. If you're, for example, a student sitting in a classroom next to somebody that you don't know, that's where we actually, the contact tracing is more effective. And this is probably a location that you're less concerned privacy-wise because it's a public location. If you go to a grocery store, for example, the fact that you're in a grocery store is probably less of a privacy concern for you. But at the same time, that's a very important piece of information for contact tracing.
We're talking to Dr. Cyrus Shahabi, professor of computer science at the University of Southern California. Now, doctor, you've been working on an app for research purposes that addresses some of what you think is lacking in the current approaches. How does your app work?
First of all, the app is voluntarily, and then we have an e-consent, and you basically, it's a research app, so it's not operational in use anywhere. But assuming that you agree and use the app, basically it does collect GPS location and also collect Bluetooth. And it uses these privacy measures on the app so that you can decide how much of your location information you want to reveal. And there are some research ideas. It's not implemented in the app yet, but one of them is actually some sort of an iterative approach on what locations you want to share. In a sense, we want to basically measure the value of the information and then tell you, for example, if you share this location that you currently is hiding, that would save, let's say, 10 more people. So basically trying to incentivize people to share location at better granularity or at more frequency.
That's Dr. Cyrus Shahabi, professor of computer science at the University of Southern California. Doctor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
With the Tokyo Games postponed, Olympic hopefuls around the world will have to wait until 2021 to compete. Many of these athletes have been preparing for years only to have their routines derailed by social distancing measures. So we checked with two LA-based athletes to find out how they're training in spite of the lockdown.
My name is Haley Anderson. I compete in the 10-kilometer open water marathon swim. So very long. It takes about 2 hours. But yeah, I do 99% of my training in the pool. I'm really a creature of habit and structure. And at first, when everything was shut down, I was really floundering without a schedule. I mean, now I'm staying at a friend's house in Las Vegas, and her mom has a pool in her backyard. And so now I have a little bit more space. But the first month of the lockdown, I was in my apartment in LA, which is not the biggest. And then also seeing on social media, I was getting in my own head about how everyone is way more well-equipped than I am. Everyone has home gyms, which I'm stunned by. At the time, I had a medicine ball and a kettlebell. And I was like, this is what I'm working with. Everyone has like full-on setups in their garage. Like, how did I not know about this? So I was getting really nervous about that. Like, wow, I'm not equipped for this. And I mean, I'm definitely not gonna come out of this a better athlete, but I think being able to come out of this with a great outlook and just a positive mental spirit, I think is gonna help me as an athlete. I mean, I've always been great with downtime because I'm convinced being an elite athlete, you have to be good at resting and recovering your body as well. So I've been pretty good about relaxing and watching Netflix and things like that.
Hi, I'm April Ross. I'm an Olympic beach volleyball player. The Tokyo Olympics would be my third Olympics. I got the silver medal in London with Jen Kessie. I got the bronze medal in Rio with Carrie Walsh. And I literally have one thing missing from my trophy closet at this point, and it's a Olympic gold medal. Yeah, when Tokyo got postponed and rescheduled, it definitely threw me for a loop. I've been playing this sport for a long time, and so a whole nother year, especially when we were already, you know, in the middle of Olympic prep in our preseason, to have it pushed back was a little bit deflating. We've definitely come to terms with the fact that we're going to probably be starting from square one when we get back on the sand. When this all hit, I realized, you know, okay, we're not going to be able to train on the beach anymore. So I found an old net in my garage and I put it up in my front yard, and everybody was coming up with all these challenges. And so I put my own spin on a couple things. It was so much fun and kind of blew my mind how rapidly the, you know, quote unquote April Ross challenge caught on and spread. We have, like I said, the net in our front yard, and I think it was the first week we were in self-quarantine and we were being all goofy still, and I was like, I need to do something, post on social media just for fun. And I got in my bikini and I was going to do something else, and I came out front and I was just kind of like playing with the ball, and one of my roommates was like, what if we put a board there at an angle and like tried to get it come back over the net and see how many times you could do it? And I'm like, yeah, why not, let's do that. And we filmed it and I put it up and it just blew up.
Playground version of April Ross Challenge.
A little variation on the April Ross Challenge.
And I figured out a way to get some touches on the ball.
But the thing is, like, it was just for fun, but it's a really good drill too. And people are looking for ways to practice volleyball during this time. Club coaches and stuff like, yes, thank you for, you know, inspiring my kids to practice, you know, when we're not training. And just to have a little bit of influence like that is really meaningful for me, obviously. What we're going through right now is a challenge, and I think to inspire kids to find the silver lining and find ways to get better and improve through sports in this time. Yeah, I'm stoked that people are being active and playing volleyball.
Those were Olympic qualifiers Haley Anderson and April Ross. The worldwide effects of the coronavirus are not felt equally. It all depends on where you are. LA County is huge, and just knowing the macro numbers of the area isn't enough, because what's happening in Long Beach may have absolutely nothing to do with what's going on in Pasadena. Why local news matters in a global crisis. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
She's just the kind of girl I like. She loves to ride my motorbike. She's got a set of curves like a roller coaster. A pretty pair like a pin-up poster. Oh, and she knows that I like it. Says if you want, you can ride all night with me. Just get on board, baby, hang on tight to me. Because your love's like a motorcycle. Now, baby, don't let me crash. Burn. No, no, please.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. Advocates are worried that military veterans will be disproportionately affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of veterans work in the industries most affected by layoffs, and the stay-at-home orders have disrupted support groups. Some organizations in Southern California are trying to meet the need by shifting their services online. KPCC's Emily Elena Dugdale has a story.
3, 2, 1, come on, round 4, here we go, this is it.
I'm in the middle of a workout led by a veteran support group called Merging Vets and Players, or MVP. There's over 60 former service members, mostly combat veterans, doing high knees, dropping down to do push-ups, then
squat or jump squat.
But we're not in a gym together. Veterans are working out virtually on a giant Zoom call in their bedrooms, their living rooms. I'm watching one guy swinging his boxing gloves in his backyard.
We're going to build off that 2-3-2 combo.
After a half hour, the workout ends and it turns into a group conversation.
This is where we can open up. There's all sorts of fighters here.
This is similar to what this group did in person. They'd hit the gym and swap stories of their time in the service. But now the conversation has shifted to the fears and concerns about getting through the COVID-19 crisis. Former Marine Elliot Ruiz says his wife had a COVID-19 scare after just having a baby. They were running low on water and diapers until Ruiz mentioned it to the group last week.
An hour later, I just saw a guy masked up, ring my bell, drop off a couple cases of water, a couple packs of diapers, and just run off into the night.
An Army veteran named Greg is also on this call. Greg's in L.A. trying to make it as an actor, so we agreed not to use his last name. He moved out of a transitional housing program for veterans in Hollywood just as COVID-19 forced people to stay indoors.
It was kind of a very stressful time to move out. I stayed there for a long time.
Greg is nearly 2 years sober and before COVID-19 regularly attended 12-step recovery groups with other veterans to stay on track. They've managed to move online, so for now he's not skipping meetings. But I joined one of Greg's virtual recovery meetings and saw people on the call from places like New York and Washington State. Greg says that's one upside of being online.
It's been a real blessing. We've been able to identify recovery communities that are thriving across the U.S.
In total, he's plugged into about 5 support groups a week online. But some problems are too big for a support group to solve. Jacob Toops is the executive director of MVP. The organization surveyed its members in late March as the COVID crisis started to hit home.
38% of them have lost child care support. 35% of them have lost their jobs at that point.
Toop says there's also been a drastic increase in veterans reaching out for mental health support services. He says many avenues for help are overwhelmed or have collapsed due to the virus.
Our program staff are now on the phone all the time, every day, trying to get them connected to the resources.
Toop says right now it feels like everyone is just trying to put their own oxygen mask on. And what he's most nervous about is that people aren't thinking about what's going to happen in 6 or 8 months, when businesses might be open, but the problems will still linger. Covering veterans and the military, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
Among the many struggling businesses out there, the news biz. Even before the pandemic, more than 1 in 5 newspapers in the United States folded during the past 15 years. And now news organizations are stumbling as advertisers no longer have the money to place ads. Some are finding lifelines, though. Newspapers such as the Burbank Leader were about to fold until getting purchased by a media owner. And Facebook recently awarded grants to many organizations throughout the country, including the Black Voice News in Riverside and the Long Beach Post. But as you've heard many times during our own pledge drives, journalism such as ours helps keep you informed and keeps public officials in check. So when organizations go under or staffs are cut, there are real consequences. Here to help us explain, we have now Mike Barthel, senior researcher at Pew Research Center. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, hyper-local newspapers have probably taken the biggest hit here. So what can these kinds of outlets do for a community? Maybe even better than the big city paper that might have its own reporters in the same geographic areas.
So in our big local news survey, we did find that nearly all Americans said it was really important for local journalists to be connected to their community, to understand the history of their community, to be personally engaged in the local community. And so there could be a difference there between a place that actually publishes in your local community as opposed to a Metro Daily that has correspondent there. So if there is a local community newspaper, a local weekly, they're the prime source of original information just for that community in general.
Now, what's the connection between a community that has a strong local news operation and how involved is that community, you know, with things, say, such as voting?
There's been some research that shows a connection between greater use of local news and more voting, but it's kind of a called a virtuous circle. So there's this group, maybe 20% of local residents that are just very civically active. And so that's a cluster of activities that includes voting, that includes reading the local news, maybe includes volunteering and other sort of civic activities. The question then is kind of, what's the quality of the information that they're getting from their local news? And does it help them make kind of good decisions when it comes to politics and policy? So when you see situations, even short of a outlet closing, when you see staffing being cut, that means less resources for investigative journalism, for verifying facts. And so people will still be carrying on with their, you know, volunteering and their voting, but they'll be doing it with different information than they would have otherwise.
But just to be clear, reading local news, being up on local newspapers and what they cover, doesn't make someone go out and be more politically active. It just maybe makes them more likely to be aware of this.
Yeah. And if there is no local newspaper, there is no local TV covering your neighborhood, you might turn to Facebook or turn to Nextdoor or turn to some other kind of resource. It's really kind of about the quality of the news they're getting and whether that's good original reporting or if it's kind of secondhand stuff, gossip, and other sorts of stuff you might get from these groups.
We're talking to Mike Barthel, senior researcher at Pew Research Center, about local newspapers and their coverage in communities. So about Facebook and about Nextdoor, that's what's new right now, is that in some cases, these online platforms, they function as a place where neighbors can share information with each other. Can those serve the same role as maybe more traditional news operations that have reporters and editors and are fully staffed?
Yeah, it's definitely a very different situation. You know, you'll get kind of a variety of things in these groups. It might be links to a local news story, but it also might be just, you know, I was walking down the street and I saw this happening in our neighborhood. And in that case, a reporter who can fill in some of the gaps and do some of the verification would be important. That said, the people who do participate in these kind of local Facebook news groups probably are reading the local news media anyway. So it's sort of a supplementary source at present.
Now, there are some qualities, though, that can make a community rely and trust a local news organization. And some of those are actually varying by race. So, for example, what do Latinos tend to look for in a news outlet?
So we asked this question when we did our big local news survey. We asked folks, you know, do you think that local reporters should kind of share their opinions when it comes to local issues? You know, they're local residents too. Maybe that would be valuable. And overall, most Americans said no. They said, you know, stick to the facts. But we did find that Hispanic Americans were more likely to look for that kind of opinion in their local news specifically. So they're kind of more open to that active involvement of local journalists in the life of their communities.
So what do examples like that maybe mean for local news to thrive and to a community that wants one outlet to stay alive in these times?
I mean, it really is community specific, and it kind of requires that deep local knowledge to understand, you know, maybe there's a beloved local talk radio show that's really the centerpiece of the community. And so you'd want to strengthen and kind of build out from that. Maybe in a more digital community, you could try some of these social media based approaches. So it's where it needs to be tailored to the characteristics of the community to make sure it works.
Yeah. Now, one last thing, Mike, looking at a larger organization, the LA Times recently made a deal to avoid mass staff cuts by making a deal with its guild to reduce hours and pay for the next several months. Wondering if this should be considered a positive move benefiting not only the employees, but also its readers.
Yeah, it's an interesting new strategy. Overall, we've seen newsroom jobs at newspapers fall by about half over the last 10 years. So the industry as a whole has seen just a massive diminution in the number of journalists on the ground. It sort of remains to be seen whether or not this will impact reporting. It may be helpful to have beat reporters stay on staff at least part-time so you don't lose that expertise. But overall, you know, the less hours you can dedicate to news gathering, the less quality information you're going to get.
It's Mike Barthel, senior researcher at Pew Research Center. Mike, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, you just heard why local news matters in a global crisis, but you know that local news always matters pre-pandemic, during the pandemic, and post-pandemic. And that's because while this is happening to the world, it's important to know what's going on in your world. So please, please support us here at kpecc.org or las.com. Go to either one of those addresses and please support this local radio station, this local news source. All right, coming up next, another story of why local news matters, a California newspaper with 167-year history that was just rescued. That's next. I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was younger, I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was stronger, the can-can such a pretty show to steal your heart away. The backstage back on earth again. The dressing room. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. All right, let's head up to the Western Sierras and to the town of Downeyville. There you're going to find the offices of the Mountain Messenger, California's oldest running weekly newspaper. It's been around since 1853, and it's fairly famous for having Mark Twain as an early contributor. Earlier this year, the ink almost ran dry for the paper when the former owner decided to retire, but then a new owner swept in and threw a lifeline to the small communities up there, where local news about the coronavirus can be hard to come by. Katie Bernstein has that story.
Downeyville is an old mining town of about 300 people. It's surrounded by forest, in a canyon, and it sits at the fork of two rivers. The population is older, there's no hospital for miles, and the internet service is spotty. The town itself is like a time capsule. The newsroom of the Mountain Messenger sits on the second floor of an old mud and rock building, with a veranda overlooking Main Street. The paper's new owner, Carl Butts, says a newspaper helps to keep a community thriving.
If you don't have a newspaper, your identity goes away. People don't know what other people are doing. You know, it isolates you to not have some common ground that everybody knows about.
Carl says part of what he's doing at the Mountain Messenger is what he calls scrapbook journalism. People want to see photographs of themselves, of people they know in the paper. As editor, he covers county board meetings and local poetry contests and writes a lot about the history and culture of the town. He also dispels local rumors. Recently, Carl received a call from a man in Sierra City saying he heard the Mountain Messenger had gone digital.
I was able to squelch this rumor and say that the Mountain Messenger has absolutely no plans to ever abandon newsprint.
His staff is tiny. It's Carl and a part-time office manager, but he's rich in local volunteers.
I'm encouraging people to send in their stories because we shouldn't let this writing business be taken over by professionals.
He's got a sixth grader who's transcribing oral histories and a 90-year-old who's writing out parts of his memoir about the summer of 48 in Downeyville. But lately, Carl's also been printing pieces on unemployment and tracking COVID-19 cases in neighboring counties. The COVID crisis has been the death knell of already struggling newspapers and weeklies across the country, as advertisements and other funding sources have dropped off. The Mountain Messenger almost met the same fate. Don Russell, the paper's former owner, put the paper up for sale last year after running it for nearly 30 years. There weren't many bites, and most people thought it was the end of the paper's long streak. But Carl rescued it from certain death.
Don Russell, the old editor, thought I was absolutely bonkers to even consider buying the paper.
Why?
You couldn't make any money on it. And I know he didn't make much money on the damn thing over the years.
Carl is 71, he's tall and lanky, he chain smokes, he's got a silver front tooth and he smiles easily. He used to work as a computer programmer and a labor economist for the state. He gets Social Security payments, so he didn't need the paper to earn him a paycheck.
When it got down to it, I just couldn't stomach the idea of it not continuing.
Most days, Carl works out of the newsroom, cup of coffee in hand, probably smoking, typing out headlines in the cluttered newspaper office. Unless it's Thursday. Thursday is printing day at the press, which is in Quincy, a 90-minute drive from Downeyville.
You'd go up North Fork of the Yuba for about, 25 miles, and it's just a majestic view every time.
Once he gets to Quincy, he picks up the paper from the press. He packs the stacks in his truck and sets off across Sierra County. Carl is also the delivery man.
I've got Quincy, Portola, Calpine, Sierraville, Loyalton, Sierra City, Downeyville, Camptonville, Nevada City, Grass Valley.
After he saved the paper, his story received national press and his subscriber numbers went up. He sells about 300 papers a week in newsstands across the county, but he's got nearly 800 subscribers across 36 states. But in Sierra County, readers rely on the Mountain Messenger as a primary source of local news. At last check, there were no confirmed cases of COVID here. But people are worried. The closest hospital is an hour's drive away. They hope the tourists stay home.
There's all kinds of talk about, all these people are coming up here bringing the virus with them. I mean, there are people up here who would like to have us stop people at the county line. I mean, it's really ironic that this county lives off of people coming to visit. Our only export is the beauty we've got.
Carl lives in a rustic cabin on the side of a mountain, totally off the grid. He's got no cell service, no internet. His daughter lives out of town and is worried about him, especially after he was snowed in for days up there in March. At her urging, Carl moved into the newsroom. He brought in a futon, set up a makeshift kitchen in the old dark room, plugged in a Mr. Coffee maker. He's been making soft-boiled eggs in an electric kettle.
I like it, actually. There's no commute. I'm here to work. There's always work to do on the newspaper.
In the first issue after he took over the paper, Carl wrote in his editor's letter describing the times in his life that newspapers had been with him. He wrote, "Newspapers have affirmed my existence time and time again. Keeping this paper alive is maintaining a love affair." He says, in some ways, keeping the paper going was like a protest, a fight against losing the essential things.
But there's a certain amount of rebellion that's involved in what I've done. And I, God damn it. No. If I have a chance to make a difference in this, I'm going to do it. We'll see how long I last, but so far, so good.
And the Mountain Messenger presses on another day. For the California Report, I'm Katie Bernstein.
All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. You can always find us. You can always find us on Twitter at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.